Hierdie inset word aan jou gebring met die komplimente van Radio Kaapse Kansel 729 AM. Besoek ons gerus by www.capepulpit.co.za.
Jy luister na die ABBA-program Krag van die Woord. Dit is heerlik om jou welkom te heet by die program wat ons in die volgende uur en twee programme in een met mekaar gaan gesels. In die eerste plek gaan ons eers gesels met Bible Projects, hulle potgooi reeks, the Exodus Way, wat wonderlike pad is wat ons saam kan loop, vooral ook in hierdie tyd, waar ons nou gaan binnenkort ingaan, sal die tyd, ja, einde van die jaar, en dan begin ons dink oor die, eintlik die hele Bybel gaan oor Jesus, so bring Bible Projects dit ook vir ons. Maar ons gaan vandag kyk na Exodus in the Creation and Flood Stories. Exodus, Jesus wat ons ook uit die slavernij uitgelei het, om ons vry te maak. En dan gaan ons kyk hoe dieselfde verhaal die Here vir ons bring van die begin af. Hierdie program, die eerste deel is aan die Bible Project potgooi, en aan die tweede deel gaan ons juist gesels verder op Matteus, en ons gaan met Matteus 11 begin vandag. Hoe lees ons die Bybel, en hoe kan ons die krag van die woord van die Here ervaar? Die lewende woord van God. Hy wat self woord geword het, soos Johannes dit in Johannes 1 vir ons gee, om ons uit die duisternis na die lig te lei. Die krag van die woord, wat die Gees in ons werk, wat in ons woon, met wie ons een geword het. Dit is die verhaal, en dit is die werklikheid, waarin die Here ons bring, deur sy woord. ABBA bring hierdie program vir ons luisteraars, om dan ook werklik mense te kan help vanuit die woord, op 'n wyse wat Jesus bedoel het, dat ons juist die dinge waarmee ons worstel in ons persoonlike lewe, ons verhoudingslewe en ons lewe in hierdie wêreld met al sy druk en sy uitdagings en die versoekings wat daar is, en die beproewings. Ons wil juis uit die woord, dit waar oor Radio Kaapse Kansel ook gaan, om die woord te bring aan mense. Die enigste verskil is wanneer jy werklik worstel met 'n bepaalde probleem, om dan in te bel na Kaapse Kansel by 021-180-5744. En met een persoon te praat, wat opgelei is, jy is uit die woord, om werklik te help verstaan, hoe ons kan verander, en hoe ons kan groei binne hierdie omstandighede, hoe ons dit kan verstaan en verander. Jy kan ook na ABBA se webwerf gaan, www.abbo, dit is abbo.org.za. Of vir Mariekie bel by 084-501-1102. Ons gaan vandag nou juist begin met hierdie reeks, wat ons in die volgende weke, dwarsdeur na die einde van die jaar, gaan neem. Die hele Exodus, en hoe dit 'n thema is dwarsdeur die Bybel. Die pad uit slavernij, die pad deur die wildernis. So, die pad uit, die slavernij in Egypte, die slavernij van die sonde dan, wat ons vandag het, wat toch altyd daar is ook, die slavernij, die verlossing van die bose, dan die pad deur die wildernis, en die pad in die beloofde land. Hoe kan ons dit verstaan? En hoe kan ons dit dan ook verstaan in ons lewe vandag? Hierdie drie momente, oor en oor in die storielyn van die Bybel. En het begin reeds in Genesis, nog voor die gebeure in Exodus. Bible Projects, Tim en John, bespreek die betekenis hiervan in Exodus. En ook die vroegere stories vanuit Genesis, die skepping en die sonvloed verhaal, hoe dit eintlik 'n uittog is, 'n pad uit, en dan deur die wildernis, en dan in die land, die land, die beloofde land wat die Here vir ons gee. Iets wonderliks om na uit te sien. Kom ons luister nou na hierdie potgooi van Bible Projects. Baie gerus ingeskakel.
The Exodus story is the most referenced story across the whole Bible. It's the road out of slavery, the road through the wilderness, and the road into the land of inheritance. This is the theme of the road, or the highway, or simply, the way. Now, one of the most iconic images in the Exodus story is when Israel leaves Egypt, Pharaoh's armies chasing after them, and the sea of reeds is in front of them, blocking them in. But miraculously, God splits the waters. There's a wall of water on the right, a wall of water on the left, and dry ground below them as a safe passage. This image is a direct hyperlink to none other than the creation story in Genesis 1. And so in this episode, we begin at the beginning, and we see how Genesis 1 shows that the creation of the land is a type of Exodus liberation.
Yahweh is said to split the waters in the middle and separate between the waters and the waters. The land was trapped under dark waters and then liberated when God exposed the dry ground so that the fruit can go out of the land.
In the biblical imagination, chaotic waters represent nothingness and non-life. And so to walk through the waters and to be safe is a picture of God holding back chaos to make a passage through.
The waters in the Exodus story represent this death boundary that the Israelites can't get past unless God does something for them that they can't do for themselves.
Today, Tim Mackey and I discuss the chaos waters of Genesis 1. We see how it connects to Noah's flood and Israel's passage through the sea. And then we connect all of this to the symbol of baptism, going through the waters of death in order to find life on the other side. This is our journey, and it's the journey of the entire cosmos.
For creation to pass through its next phase of transformation into the life God has for it, it will mean an ending of the life that we've created for ourselves here out of Eden into true life, but it will feel like a kind of death.
Thanks for joining us. Here we go. Hey, Tim.
Hi, John. Hello.
Hello. We are continuing in this new theme study on the Exodus, or the new Exodus, the road out, but also the road in between and the road back in.
Yeah. Yep.
You told us this is kind of a center of gravity. This is the main grand narrative of the Bible.
Yes. And by Exodus story, we mean the story going from Exodus through, in terms of like the scrolls, the Hebrew Bible, through the scroll of Joshua. Hmm. So out of slavery, through the wilderness, into the promised land, is the story told in Exodus through Joshua. And that whole story arc gets picked up and told and retold and used like a template to describe other past events in the history of Israel, in the Hebrew Bible, and then gets turned into a template for the prophet's hope for what God will do in the future. And it's the template that apparently Jesus saw his life mission through, because it culminated in Passover week in Jerusalem. And then when you see his earliest followers using Exodus language and imagery to talk about just what we might call like the basics of Christian belief, you realize that a Christian view of reality is itself has an Exodus-shaped story. Hmm. What is also true then is when you go backwards from the Exodus story into the book that comes before it, Genesis, what you can also see there is there are a number of key events before the Exodus that have been shaped with an eye towards the Exodus story. So even though these events precede the Exodus story, in terms of the design of the Torah, it seems that the authors of the shape of Genesis, that we now have it, was shaped by someone who wanted us to see the Exodus itself prefigured and anticipated by key events in the story of Genesis, which is what I want to focus on in this conversation in the next one.
Okay.
There is a sense in which the seven-day creation story can be thought of, if you read the Torah as a whole, rereading it, you begin to see language and imagery of the Exodus in the seven-day creation story. You can think of creation as a liberation from chaos and non-being into the blessing of the abundant garden land.
You know, you said that by the time you get to the end of the Bible, that's the way the biblical authors are thinking about the Exodus. It's the big history.
Yes. Yeah.
All of creation.
Yeah. The cosmic story.
The cosmic story is an Exodus story.
Yeah.
So what I hear you saying is, while the Exodus story proper, which becomes the template to become the cosmic story, hasn't even happened yet.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Genesis 1 begins kind of thinking about that cosmic story.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. You can almost think of direction of dependence. So here I'm just merely speculating that perhaps one of the influences on the author of Genesis 1, the seven-day creation story, was itself the historical memory and shape of the Exodus traditions and story, so that the seven-day creation story was given certain little flavors and vocabulary images precisely to anticipate the Exodus story. Or you could say it works backwards. When you come to the Exodus story, what you're really seeing is a creation story. Maybe it's not that creation is an Exodus story. Maybe it's that the Exodus is a creation story.
Okay.
And I think it's probably meant to see like electricity flowing both ways. The first creation story, the seven-day narrative, begins with a summary. It's the first line of the Bible. In the beginning, Elohim created the skies and the land. How exactly did that happen? Verse 2, the action begins. Now, you should know the pre-creation state. The land was wild and waste, and darkness was over the face of the deep, that is, the deep waters.
The abysmal waters.
The abysmal waters. But the ruach, the spirit or breath or wind of Elohim, was fluttering or hovering over the face of those waters. So we begin with an overall positive summary statement. It makes you think like, okay, Elohim's in control here. Elohim's creating sky and land. So the end result is already anticipated in the opening line. Now we begin with some kind of conflict. And really, the only candidate for any kind of plot conflict in the seven-day creation story is in this opening pre-creation statement of just the description of the nothingness or the disordered or non-ordered world.
Yeah, the chaos.
Yeah. And so we have land that's unordered, we have darkness, and then we have deep, unformable or unformed chaos waters. But the spirit of Elohim is there hovering. What I want to focus on is days 2 and 3. Because what those are all about is dealing with those deep, chaotic abyss waters. So the first day, God says, let there be light, famously, and you have day and night. And that deals with the darkness problem. God contains the darkness and
orders the darkness.
Yep, orders the darkness. Day 2 begins like this. Verse 6, Elohim said, let there be a
rakia.
Rakia, in the middle of the waters, in the middle of the waters. That's an interesting way to say that. Let it separate between waters from the waters.
Yeah. It's dividing.
It's dividing. Yeah. Now here is dividing vertically the waters because Elohim made the rakia, the dome, and he separated the waters which were below the dome and between the waters which were above the dome. And it was so. Elohim called the dome skies. And you're like, ah. Remember the first line, in the beginning, Elohim created skies and land.
Oh, we got there.
That's where skies came from. He called it skies, there was evening, there was morning, the second day.
And the skies are the waters now above.
Yeah. So there's waters above, we're talking about the blue spherical, half spherical dome over our heads. Mm-hmm. And look, it's January in Portland.
Ooh.
We've just been through a crazy week of
just slobber
snow
fest.
And ice rain, and it felt so dark.
Yeah.
And so sad.
But the sun's out right now.
But I'm looking outside and I see the Rakia, the blue dome. It's a thing of beauty.
It does kind of look like an ocean up there if you think of it that way.
Yes. Yeah. The hue or the color
yeah.
matches what an Israelite would see if they went out to the coast and looked on the Mediterranean Sea.
Yeah.
It would be also blue.
So these are matching kind yeah. of waters.
Yeah. It's the waters above and the waters below.
Because waters do come down from there.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. I mean, we know the waters are not coming from the blueness, right?
Oh, right. Yeah. The blueness is the, right, the...
What is the blueness?
The light of the sun reflecting off of
the atmosphere.
The atmosphere, which there's water vapor
okay.
as a part of the atmosphere, but
that's
it's
true.
Most all kinds of other gas.
Yeah, it's lots of gases.
Gases.
And, stuff. Yeah,
and okay. it's the light reflecting off
but that's
the gas.
That's the waters
molecules.
Above.
Yep. And then the waters below are the oceans and the sea.
Yeah.
But notice here, Yahweh is said to split the waters in the middle
yeah.
and separate between the waters and the waters.
One big chaotic, watery
mm-hmm. yeah.
cosmos.
Yeah.
Now there's order,
mm-hmm.
sky, and waters below.
That's right. This language right here, separating between waters and waters so that there's something in the middle, this is all the vocabulary from Exodus chapter 14 when God splits the waters from the waters and in between is the dry land. And actually, sorry, I've stole the thunder of day three.
Oh.
Because the next day is about the dry land.
Day three is the dry land comes
yeah.
out of the waters below.
But my point here is that the language being used in Exodus 14 to describe the splitting of the waters from the waters so that they are a wall on the right and a wall on the left and in the middle is where the people walk.
Yeah.
That is language recalling this language from day two.
Splitting chaos waters
mm-hmm.
is mm-hmm. a connection
mm-hmm.
to the splitting of the Red Sea,
mm-hmm.
which is an Exodus motif.
Yeah. Or the Exodus motif is drawing on a creation motif. It flows both ways.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a good example of just a little hint. You wouldn't notice that maybe mm-hmm. on the first read through or
yeah.
even a 50th.
Right.
But at some point, you would begin to notice the creation language in the Exodus story.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's day two. Then the next day, day three, and Elohim said, let the waters below the skies, and you're like, oh yeah, there's waters above, waters below. Let those waters below the skies be gathered into one place. And let the dry ground become seeable or visible. And it was so. Elohim called the dry ground land. And you're like, ah.
Now we got the land.
We got the skies, day two, and the land, day three. That's how it happened. And the gathering of the waters he called seas.
Hmm. The waters below wasn't the seas, it was just the chaos waters below.
Yeah.
But once it's been divided,
mm-hmm.
given its place,
mm-hmm.
it's now... the seas.
That's right. The seas. So what is fascinating, that word dry ground, it comes from the word yavesh, which means something that's dried up or withered.
Mm.
You can talk about ground that's dry, but also like in Psalm 1, the tree whose leaves never withered, they never yavesh.
Mm.
They never get brittle and dry.
Okay.
And so that word dry land comes from yavesh. It's pronounced yabasha, the yabasha. And this is the word used in Exodus 14 when the waters divide, a wall on their left, a wall on their right, and they walked in the middle on the Yabesha. So again, it's a hint forward and a hyperlink backward between the two
yeah.
stories.
Okay.
So the point is that dual movement or electricity
mm-hmm.
it sparks your imagination.
Yeah.
And I was really the first scholar who prompted me to think about this many years ago, scholar Michael Morales, in a little book called, actually, not a little book. Why did I say a little book? It's not little at all. It was really expensive, too. Called The Tabernacle Prefigured, Cosmic Mountain Ideology in Genesis and Exodus. Whew. It's his dissertation.
Okay.
Published. He puts it this way. He says, if one were to look for any dramatic tension in the Bible's first narrative, that's the Seventh-day creation narrative, it would be in Genesis 1, verse 2, which is the formless and void, wild and waste. The fact that the deluged land, the land that's covered, whatever land there might be, is submerged in the waters right now. The deluged land of verse 2 cannot sustain life. And it links deliverance and creation as combined acts, with the fruit of life on the land as a kind of resolution.
Mm.
So in this sense, the land was delivered from the primeval waters.
You could think of the land as being enslaved within the waters.
Yeah, it's trapped
under
the waters.
Yeah.
So after God separates the waters so that the dry land can emerge, the next thing God says is, let the land sprout vegetation.
Life.
And life. And interestingly, in Genesis 1 verse 12, and it says, and the land, and it's that word, to go out from
land.
The Exodus. The land made to go out vegetation.
Huh.
It's usually translated the land brought out or the land produced.
The land exodused.
The land made the vegetation and plants and fruit trees exodus from the dry ground.
Cool.
So the land was trapped under dark waters and then liberated when God split the waters and exposed the dry ground so that the fruit can go out of the land. The fruit goes out of the land. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So there was a time in my education where I'd be like, you're just making this up, where I would look at that quote from Michael Morales.
Oh, you're reading too much into it.
Reading too much into it.
You've been accused of that before.
Okay, yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Is that hyperlink really there? And all I can encourage someone to do is to go read Isaiah chapters 40 to 48 in particular, and look at how Isaiah constantly is drawing upon the language of the seven-day creation narrative and the garden narrative and the Exodus narrative.
Hmm.
And he mushes them all together multiple times as if they're all about one thing. So in Isaiah 43, for example, Yahweh speaking to Israel in exile, and he says, this is what Yahweh says, the one who created you, it's the word from Genesis 1:1, bara, in the one who formed you.
So Genesis 2?
That's from God forming the dirt into the human.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So he uses two words for creation
from
the two first creation stories.
Okay.
Do not be afraid, for I have redeemed you. That's the word from the Exodus story. That's a wonderful example right there.
Mm.
The seven-day story, the Eden story, and then a key word from the Exodus story. I have called you by your name, you are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. So now we're going through the sea on dry land. We're referring to that moment from Exodus 14.
Okay.
And when you go through the rivers, they won't flow over you.
Yeah, now same idea.
Same idea. We're referring to the passage of the Israelites through the Jordan River.
Oh.
Which is explicitly compared to the passage through the sea in the book of Joshua.
How do you know the second one refers to the Jordan River versus...
Oh, so the passage out of slavery is marked through waters.
Yep.
The passage into the land is marked through waters.
Yeah.
But the waters of the Jordan River. Here, both the waters and the rivers are being turned cosmic.
Yeah.
And both of them are symbols for going out of slavery in exile in Babylon to freedom back into the promised land.
Okay.
When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. When you pass through the rivers, they won't flow over you. When you walk through the fire, you won't be burned and the flame will not scorch you. Most likely, I think that's a reference that begins life with the Sodom and Gomorrah story.
The fire?
Yeah, about the remnant seed of Abraham or family of Abraham, Lot, being delivered out of the fires of Sodom and Gomorrah. But I guess the point is that Isaiah will draw on both creation stories and link them to the Exodus story.
Yeah.
And constantly in ways that force me to go back and think, maybe these stories are more deeply connected than I've ever thought to imagine. And that's what the point Morales is making here.
Cool.
Okay. So that's the seven-day creation story. It's as if the land is being delivered from the dark waters, exodus. So there's a road out of the waters in the darkness.
Mm-hmm. The land comes out of the water.
The land comes up out of the waters. So it's kind of
the road out.
Freed out of the waters.
Yeah.
And then it becomes the dry land.
Yeah. There's really no road in between. It just becomes the promised land.
Yeah. And then
it just sprouts.
The dry land, which is a reference to the wilderness, the dry land.
Oh, okay.
Just the emergence of dry land yeah, is okay. like the road in between.
Okay, okay.
And then God calls out of the dry land, garden and life.
Yeah, got it.
Which you could maybe then just say the Exodus story itself is being told on the template of Genesis 1.
Yeah.
Out of the darkness and chaos of slavery.
Right.
Into the dry land where God consistently provides watery oases and gardens and bread.
Hmm.
And then into the lush garden land.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a good example. And it's just little hints, but the more you reread the Torah and prophets, it really seems like that's what we're supposed to pick up here.
Yeah.
You can do something similar then with the next decreation and recreation story, which is the story of the flood. So after the seven-day creation story, God appoints the human images as covenant partners, and they will have access to unending life if they live by God's wisdom and word. They're deceived. They make a poor decision. And then they are exiled out of Eden in slavery. Violence erupts. Cain and Abel, Lamech, the Nephilim. And the land becomes so saturated with the blood of the innocent that God hears the outcry, and he's going to undo the order that he set up in the seven-day creation narrative. And so interestingly, the onset of the flood in Genesis 7 is described with reference to the language of days 2 and 3 in particular that we just looked at, but as a
reversal.
So in Genesis 7, verse 11, we're told that in the 600th year of Noah's life in the second month, on the 17th day of the month on that day, they were split apart, the fountains of the great deep, and the windows of the skies were opened up. There was rain on the land.
So the thing that created the separation is now split, so the separation is no longer. You've got the sky ordered, you got the sea ordered. That order is getting crushed.
Yeah, at both levels.
At both levels.
Then we're first told that the dry land splits open, and then those deep waters
come back up
through the land and
fountains of the great deep.
So that the waters below,
okay,
and then the windows of the skies.
Yeah, we got some holes in that rakia.
Yeah, the rakia cracks a bunch of holes. They were opened up. So the flood is depicted as a cosmic collapse. The whole creation reverts back to the chaos waters of Genesis 1, verse 2, and verse 12. And there was rain on the land. So now notice the word split. It's a different word from separate. So what has separated, it's another separating, but it's a separation that leads to the reunification of the waters above and below.
Yeah.
But now
we've separating was creating order. This separating is allowing disorder to come back.
It's the land splitting apart, and then the waters above and below reconnect. So now land splitting, things being split or separated can be a dual image. If the waters separate, it means salvation. But if the land splits, that's usually bad.
Decreation.
Earthquakes. So this is just a note on this. Oh, yeah. Interesting essay by a Hebrew Bible scholar, Dominic Redman, called The Use of Water Imagery in Descriptions of Sheol, that is the grave, in biblical literature. And he made a comment. This is really interesting. He says, in Genesis 1, the reader is introduced to a world in which watery chaos rules until God's intervention brings order. The flood story in Genesis 6 through 8 tells the story of how, when the world was corrupted, God withdrew the restraints placed on those waters at the time of creation, and they flooded the world once more, so the great deep and the windows of the heavens. Thus, the chaos waters, by their nature, are symbolic of the absence of order in creation. And in the flood narrative, those waters denote the reversal of creation. So again, the fact that in the Exodus story, when the Israelites leave Egypt, and then they're just like a few days out, and they meet this big body of water, and Pharaoh's army comes, and then it's you're just having it told, and then the sun set, and it was night.
Mm.
So they're at this body of water
in the darkness.
And you're meant
to think of Genesis 1.
Yeah, this is a Genesis 1 verse 2 moment.
Mm.
And they're meeting those chaos waters. And so in this way, what happens there at Exodus is God tells Moses to stretch out his hand, and we're told the waters split. And it's exactly the word used of the land splitting in the flood story, baka.
Mm.
And then God sends a wind and keeps the water separated all night long. In the flood story, right at the pivot, after the waters have been over the land for 150 days, Genesis 8, verse 1, then Elohim remembered Noah and all the creatures and all the beasts with him on the ark, and Elohim caused to pass over the land a ruach, a wind.
Noah and the creatures are floating around in an ark.
Yes. So they're in this little portable dry land. It's like a little portable yabasha made of wood.
Okay. Fascinating.
Yes. Yep.
The portable wilderness.
Yeah, the portable dry land. Yeah. And then floating on the waters, and then God causes a wind to pass over, and the waters subsided. And then look, the language of the flood reversing is stated in the language of the flood coming on. So they were closed, the fountains of the deep and the windows of the skies, and it was restrained, that is, the rain from the skies. You can just see it walking backwards. And the waters turned back from upon the land, going back, and the waters decreased at the end of 150 days. Then after this, the ark rests on a mountain.
The floating wilderness.
Yep. Waters keep decreasing. And then there's the thing about Noah sending out the birds.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason he's sending out the birds is to wait for the yabasha to appear, the dry land. So the waters are slowly receding from the wind.
Mm-hmm.
And for the yabasha to occur. And then this is so rad, man. You can't make this stuff up. There's this focus right after this of the moment the dry land appears, Noah and all the animals go out from the ark.
They go out. They exodus.
Just like the plants went out of the dry land.
Mm.
And they're depicted as the seed.
Mm.
Noah and the animals are called the seed
of
the next generations that'll come.
Yeah.
It's as if the ark is literally like a portable wilderness, dry land.
Mm.
And then God makes come out of the dry land, the seed of the new creation.
Mm.
So again, here's Michael Morales talking about the ark. He puts it this way. He says, Genesis 1's use of the verb to go out to describe plants and animals coming up out of the land is especially suggestive, he says. In the flood narrative, however, the ark is playing the role of the dry land.
Yeah.
So that all living creatures are said, in the same word, to go out of the ark. So if the creation account may be read like an exodus from chaos into order, from the waters to the dry land, then also the flood narrative can be read like an exodus from the old creation and into a new one.
Hmm.
In exiting the ark, Noah and the animals enter the new world that calls back to Genesis 1, but also anticipates the future call of Israel out of Egypt.
Hmm.
So the fruits, plants, and the animals go out of the dry land after they've been separated from the waters.
Genesis 1.
Genesis 1. Noah and the animals come out of the ark onto the mountain after the waters have been subsided after the flood.
Hmm.
Flood story.
If we were going to try to match these stories then, as much as we could. So Genesis 1 begins with the flood, but Noah's story begins kind of before there was a flood.
Oh, yeah. And it reverts back to.
So once we get to the flood, now we've got, in Genesis 1, there's the flood.
Mm-hmm.
The land is kind of submerged underneath, needing salvation.
Mm-hmm.
In Noah's flood, Noah's floating on top as kind of, he's not submerged underneath, but he's floating on top.
That's right, yeah.
But it's the potential of the land. It's the dry land needing to be freed.
Yes.
And then in Genesis 1, God separates the waters so the land can emerge.
God's spirit wind is there.
God's spirit's wind there. The separates the waters. In Noah's story, the wind comes, the waters die down so that the land can reappear.
Mm-hmm.
And in Genesis 1, we read that seed goes out.
Mm. The plants and the fruit trees with seed in them.
Yeah.
Go out up from the
go
land.
Go out up from the land. And in Noah's flood, him as the seed and the animals as the seed go out from
the ark.
The ark
into onto the land. The dry land,
Okay.
To be fruitful and multiply.
Be fruitful and multiply.
Yeah. Yep.
And then in the Exodus story, when the Israelites experience God's justice as a flood of the 10th plague, and them being saved from that with Passover is a type of ark.
Yeah, the house. The house is a type of ark.
They go into the house, they paint the blood on the
door
frame.
That's right. And let us not forget the phrase in the Passover narrative, into the house, betah. Is the word ark, the Hebrew word ark, spelled backwards.
Let us not forget.
it's a pun meant to depict the Passover house you enter as a kind of ark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now there's a flood, but they're freed from the oppression.
The building of the plagues, one after another, begins to recall the rising of the floodwaters.
Oh, okay.
To this peak event,
yeah,
which then is the night of Passover.
And so when they leave and they're confronted by a big piece of chaotic waters that they need to pass through, this is now evoking all of these ideas of the chaos waters subsiding or being split apart.
They split apart. That's
so that you can
walk
pass
on dry
through.
Land in the middle. Okay. Yeah. So really there's two cycles of creation and flood in the rising up to Passover and the deliverance out of Egypt.
Okay.
Then Egypt chasing them to the waters and then the splitting of the waters and they pass through. It's like a double deliverance.
It's interesting. Yeah, it's the waters coming up and then the waters subsiding. And you're delivered in both instances.
Yeah, that's right.
Because you're delivered from the oppression that the flood is getting rid of. But then you're being delivered from the chaos
out
the other side.
Yeah. And again, back to that passage in Isaiah 43 we read a little bit ago. When Isaiah dreams and describes how this God is going to rescue his people out of slavery to exile in Babylon, he calls himself the creator of Israel to bring them through the waters and through the rivers on the way to a new land.
Yeah.
So he's linking creation and Exodus and flood all together.
So when we get to the symbol of baptism, and you're going into the waters to be united in death, I'm thinking of a flood going into divine justice that is, in one sense, making things right by dealing with oppression, but now I'm in it and I need to then come up out of it. And now coming up out of the waters is the symbol of being rescued into a new way of life, a new land.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So just real quick, there's one reference in the New Testament to the flood story that links it to Christian baptism. Really fascinating. It begins with talking about how Jesus, this is in 1 Peter 3:18, the context is he's saying, listen, your Roman, Greek and Roman neighbors are going to think you're crazy and probably like evil for deviating from normal Roman custom and way of life and following this crucified Jewish Messiah. So he says, listen, have courtesy and respect to all your neighbors. If people make fun of you, at least let them not be able to make fun of how you live and treat each other. And he says, if you suffer for doing good, you're imitating Jesus, who suffered and died, this is verse 18, in order that he could bring you to God. He was put to death in the flesh, but made alive by the Spirit. And by the Spirit, he also went and proclaimed or announced to the spirits that are now in prison. What he is most likely referring to is the tradition of the Nephilim who were killed in the flood.
Oh.
And there's a whole bunch of traditions in Second Temple Jewish literature about how the spirits of the Nephilim were imprisoned after the flood.
Okay. So he's going to proclaim to them, I'm king?
Yeah, and so Jesus is the victor, not just over the powers of heaven, but even over the spiritual powers that unleashed evil on the land in the past. And he says, those spirits that are now imprisoned were formerly disobedient when the patience of God waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being built, in which a few, that is, eight souls, were rescued through the water.
Mm.
So it's a reference to the flood story.
Okay.
The Nephilim, they're now in prison.
Because the Nephilim is a part of what leads up to the flood story.
Yeah. The violence of the Nephilim that soaks the land in innocent blood is what causes the final climactic outcry of the innocent to rise up to God to bring the flood waters.
That's a whole rabbit hole, I guess, we're explaining to anyone listening.
But what he's doing right here is recalling the flood story in the language that any Jewish person who went to synagogue and knew about the Bible would have known.
Okay.
This is as clear of reference to the flood story as he can. And notice he's likening Jesus going to his death and then being vindicated through resurrection to be exalted over the powers that brought the flood onto the land. But a few were rescued from the flood, Noah and his family in the ark. Then he says in verse 21, now also corresponding to this, and he uses the word, the Greek word antitupos.
Oh, yeah, as a type.
It's where we get the word type.
Yeah.
And type means pattern.
Yeah.
So now, as a matching pattern.
Think of this as a theme.
Yes. Yeah. Like, or the melody.
Yeah.
Baptism now rescues you.
Mm-hmm.
And then he clarifies, not the water removing dirt from your body. Mm-hmm. No. The appeal to God from a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Messiah.
Hmm.
So when you appeal to God to rescue you, and you are trusting that somehow you are rescued through the resurrection of Jesus Messiah, you say, God, rescue me through what you did through raising Jesus. And baptism is like this ritual that you go through matching Noah's passing through the waters.
Mm.
And as you do that, you're actually matching Jesus entering into death, because the flood corresponds to Jesus being put to death and then being made alive. And then he has Noah going into the waters, being rescued through it. And then you have baptism with you going into the waters and you appealing.
He merges all three of these ideas
all
together.
All three of these ideas are antitupoi of each other. And then he says of Jesus, now he's at the right hand of God, having gone into the skies with angels, authorities, and powers subject to him. Those spirits in prison, he is now king over them all. And if you are in the ark with Noah going through the waters, that is going into death with Jesus so you can be raised with him, then you will reign with him too. But notice how dense this is.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting? But he's drawing on the hyperlinks that connect creation, flood, and then a rescue. Notice he used that word rescue. The baptism now rescues you.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Rescue is the word that comes from the Exodus story, from the story of Israel going through the water of the sea. So Peter, who wrote this, his mind was so saturated in these stories. And the stories, it's almost like he lays them all on top of each other.
Yeah.
And can draw language from any of them as if they're all talking about the same thing.
Mm-hmm. What does he mean by the phrase good conscience? Right at the center of the baptism, it's like he calls it an appeal to God for a good conscience.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. So we ended up here spontaneously.
Yeah.
So it's a good question. I have a thought on it, but I just want to say it's a
spontaneous.
Spontaneous thought. He's making this clarification that baptism rescues you. And that could mean a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And then he quickly clarifies, it's not the water removing dirt from your flesh. It's what baptism means.
Yeah.
And then when he unpacks it, it's about you personally coming to God, seeing your genuine need to be rescued, and that rescue is possible through the resurrection of Jesus. I think that's what he means. An appeal to God from a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus.
You're asking for a good conscience. And is that what he's
saying? No. It's sort of like out of a good conscience, out of genuine motives, you appeal to God.
Why does it say for a good conscience?
Yeah. My hunch is it has to do with the Greek preposition there. Yeah, there's no word for there. It's just the genitive of. I think a more helpful translation would be an appeal to God from a good conscience.
Meaning you really desire this.
Yeah, it's a genuine motive.
It's a genuine desire.
Like you really...
You're not checking a box. You're like, I want to be part of a new creation.
Not striking a deal with God.
Yeah.
You really come to see, oh my gosh.
This is what I want. My desires are now his desires.
Left to myself, I'm headed for the chaos waters.
Yeah.
But through the resurrection of Jesus, I can, with a genuine conscience, appeal to God to rescue me through the waters.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The waters don't have to be where my life ends. I mean, that's really, the waters are where the story begins, and it's the opposite of life and creation. The waters of the flood represent an ending of all that was good and living. And the waters in the Exodus story represent this death boundary that the Israelites can't get past unless God does something for them that they can't do for themselves.
So the waters can be thought of as the chaotic state from which life can't be life unless it's ordered. You know, God brings the plagues, and the plagues are like the waters. But it's interesting in this passage in 1 Peter, I think he blames the waters on the Nephilim.
Yeah, the spirits in prison. He's connecting it there, who are disobedient.
Because in a way, it's like, what is the floodwaters? Well, the floodwaters is God's justice, but it's also just our evil fully unleashed.
Yes, absolutely.
We can experience that right now in our own lives. You can experience kind of the flood.
Yeah, that's right.
Running into your own evil and letting that just keep you down. And then there's also this idea of like, there's a final boundary, I think is the phrase you used. We're going to eventually, this flood will be all there is unless you can get through it.
Yeah. Maybe here, let's turn to the parable Jesus tells at the end of the Sermon on the Mount about the floodwaters that are coming. The storm is coming. And you can build your house on the sand. You can build your house on the rock. And only the house on the rock will endure through the storm and the flood. For creation to pass through its next phase of transformation into the life God has for it, it will mean an ending of the life that we've created for ourselves here outside of Eden.
Yeah.
Into true life, but it will feel like a kind of death.
It'll be a reckoning of sorts.
Yeah.
And a reestablishing of certain order. And it will feel like a death.
Yeah, that's right. And that's actually true to how the Exodus story works in Exodus.
Okay.
The people of Israel aren't entirely happy
that they've
been brought out of Egypt.
Yeah, the order they had in Egypt was kind of nice.
At least it was predictable. With this Yahweh, he makes you live by faith. And you don't know where the next act of provision might be coming from. So maybe slavery, but with predictable food is better.
That's interesting.
So it's a kind of death to pass into life. And Peter ties creation, flood, Exodus, together with Christian baptism, into death and into life.
Thanks for listening to Bible Project Podcast. Next week, we continue in Genesis, and we turn to the stories of Abraham and Sarah, and we discover that they go through their own pre-Exodus Exodus.
You can look for Exodus themes in Genesis in the story of Abraham, who goes out of Ur of the Chaldeans, out of Mesopotamia, into the land.
And we'll look at how Abraham, in the land, acts as a Pharaoh-like oppressor, creating injustice that other people need to be saved from.
He and his wife end up sadly oppressing an Egyptian slave. And there's all kinds of extra themes going on with that.
That's next week. Bible Project is a crowdfunded nonprofit, and we exist to experience the Bible as a unified story that leads to Jesus. Everything that we make is free because of the generous support of thousands of people just like you. Thank you so much for being a part of this with us.
Hi, my name is Camilla, and I'm from Brazil. I first heard about the Bible Project with Tim Mackey coming to teach at my Bible school. I use the Bible Project for getting deeper into God's Word before I teach my classes. My favorite thing about Bible Project is how they're so true to the Word itself. It's not adding and nor subtracting anything from it. We believe the Bible is a unified story that leads to Jesus. We're a crowdfunded project by people like me. Find free videos, articles, podcasts, classes, and more on the Bible Project app and at BibleProject.com. And now this part in Portuguese. Here we go. Oh my gosh. Okay. Nós acreditamos que a Bíblia é uma história unificada que leva a Jesus. Nós somos projeto fundado pelas pessoas como eu. Encontre vídeos gratuitamente, assim como artigos, podcasts, aulas e muito mais no aplicativo Bible Project. E assim, no BibleProject.com.
Hey everyone, this is Mackenzie. I'm a volunteer at Bible Project. I started volunteering about 4 months ago because of the community that the group of volunteers provides. I get to help write the cards that you receive in the mail, so you get a handwritten letter. And I continue to volunteer at Bible Project for Bob Collins' great coffee. There's a whole team of people that bring the podcast to life every week. For a full list of everyone who's involved, check out the show credits in the episode description wherever you stream the podcast and on our website.
Jy is ingeskakel by die ABU-program Krag van die Woord. En ons oordink, lees saam, luister, mediteer op hierdie eerste gedeelte van Matteus 11, van vers 1 tot 6. En die opskrif wat ek aan dit gegee het, ook vir ons gesprek ook vandag, is die koninkryk lyk anders as wat jy dink. Is iets anders as wat ons normaal weg verwag. Maar kom ons lees dit saam, die woorde van Jesus. Eers Matteus vir dan vir ons weer die skakel gee van die, na die vorige hoofstuk. Toe Jesus sy opdragte aan sy 12 disciples voltooi het, het hy daar vandaan vertrek om in hulle dorpe te leer en te preek. Toe Johannes in die tronk verneem wat Christus alles doen, het hy sy disciples gestuur om hom te vra, is u die een wat sou kom, of moet ons iemand anders verwag? Jesus het hulle geantwoord, gaan vertel vir Johannes wat julle hoor en sien. Blindes sien weer, en verlamdes loop. Melaatses word gereinig, dowes hoor, dooies word opgewek, en aan die armes word die goeie boodskap verkondig. En gelukkig is die mens wat nie aanstoot neem nie. Hierdie woorde van Jesus, nadat hy sy disciples uitgestuur het, en nou kom Johannes en hy vra, maar is hy die een? Is hy die een wat sou kom? Of moet ons iemand anders te verwag? So jy kan dadelijk hoor die twyfel. Die twyfel in Johannes, daar waar hy in die tronk sit, waar Herodes hom ingegooi het, op aandrang van sy vrou, sy dogter. Maar Herodes wat eintlik bang was vir Johannes, want Johannes het hom baie regheid aangevat rondom sy lewe, dat hy saam met sy broer sy vrou getrou het, en hoe hy lewe. Ja, Johannes het nie doekies omgedraai nie. Maar die korte lang van hierdie gedeelte is dat Jesus vir Johannes die Doper sê, die koninkryk waarvan jy gepreek en profeteer het, lyk baie anders as wat jy in jou gedagtes, in jou denke, verwag het. En dan gelukkig, geseend, is jy as jy dit so aanvaar en nie aanstoot neem nie. So, te woorde, want Johannes en Jesus was naby aan mekaar, hulle was familie. En Johannes, profeet, groot profeet, soos Jesus dit vir ons sê. Maar, kom ons dink 'n bietjie oor ons eie lewe. Baie min van ons se lewens werk uit soos ons dit vir ons voorgestel het, toe ons nog kinders of jong mense was. Ek dink ek is redelik gekwalifiseer om het my jare al aangestap het, en ek een lewe terug kan kyk daarop, en vir my is dit waar, dit is anders wat ek gedink het, wat ek ook al gedink het. eintlik moet ons dit as 'n feit stel en weet dat dinge is meestal heel anders as wat ons dink. Ons is van ons kinderwees af besig om te probeer uitwerk hoe dinge moet wees. Ons kan, baie van ons kan nie ver sien nie. Party van ons, die enkel is, die uitsonderlik is, weet, maar dit is die pad wat ek gaan loop. En dan sit ook baie naby daaraan. Maar dit is nie die reël nie. Ons vorm, soos wat ons aangaan en verstaan wat gebeur in ons lewe, vorm ons algaande ons gedagtes, soos wat ons dinge ervaar. Ja, dit is so ek dink hoe my lewe werk. Geleerdes praat van twee magte wat in ons lewe inwerk, natuurlike magte, geskape magte, die begeerte om te groei wat daar in ons is, soos in 'n baba wat pasgebore is, wat wil groei, sterker word, groter word en weet presies wat hy wil hê, wil kos hê en om te drink en skreeu as hy dit nie kry nie. Daai begeerte is daar, deel van ons lewe, van ons menswees, van die hele skepping van die Here. Maar dan is daar die interessante ook die, dat daar ook 'n weerstand is teen verandering in ons lewe. Sodra dit wat ons wil hê werk, dan wil ek eintlik daaraan vashou. En dan kom daar 'n weerstand in my. Ek wil nie eintlik dit verander nie, want dit werk mos. Moenie iets regmaak wat of regmaak wat nie gebreek is nie. So sê mense gewoonlik. As kind wil ek groei, sterker, slimmer wees, meer erkenning kry, suksesvol wees, aanvaarding hê. Want dit is hoe die lewe werk. As ek dit kry, dan werk alles uit, dan is dit goed. En dan gaan ek so lewe. En dan wanneer dit so werk en ek kry erkenning en ek is so suksesvol dan in terme daarvan ook. En ek leer so baie. My lewe werk. En wanneer dit werk, dan wil ek dit nie verander nie. Dan wil ek vashou net soos dit is. Dit is hoe dit gewoonlik gaan in mense se lewens. Maar dan word ek op 'n kol word ek ontnugter. Wanneer dinge nie uitwerk soos wat ek dit beplan het. En dan baie keer kom daar twyfel. Twyfel in my hart. Is ek goed genoeg? Sal ek dit maak? En selfs ook wanhoop. Nee, ek gaan dit nie maak nie. Daar is nie 'n manier hoe ek dit gaan regkry nie. Dan kom daar die twyfel. Dis hierdie twee kragte wat in ons lewe werk. Om te groei en maar dan ook, wanneer ek groei en dit werk, kom daar ook 'n weerstand. Met Johannes die Doper was dit ook maar so, wel hy deur Jesus as die grootste profeet genoem word. Hy wat die koms van die koninkryk gepreek het. Hy wat die oordeel van die Here verkondig het, wat dat jy tot bekering moet kom. Eerder om, as om die oordeel deur te gaan. Nou werk dinge nie so uit nie. Hy's in die tronk. Jesus doen heeltemal iets anders as wat hy verwag het die Messias gaan doen. Naamlik om die mag in Israel op te neem en die bose uit te skop en te oorwin. Herodes, wat hom in die tronk gegooi het, is nie koning nie. Jesus is die koning. Maar nou, wat hoor hy nou? Is hy die een wat sou kom? Is hy? Hy verstaan nie wat hier gebeur nie. Want dit is nie hoe hy dink nie. Dit is nie sy gedagtes nie, sy paradigma nie, wat hy verwag nie. En as Johannes dit nie verstaan het nie, hoe maklik is dit dat ons nie ook die koninkryk verkeerd kan verstaan nie. Dat ons dink dit is hoe dit moet wees as kind van die Here, as volger van Jesus. Ja, dit kan nogal baie sterk inwerk op 'n mens en twyfel bring. Soos Johannes in die tronk, hy verstaan glad nie wat Jesus doen nie. Dit strook nie met hoe hy dink God beloof het die Messias gaan wees nie. Hy Johannes, hy wat die Messias so goed geken het, wat gepreek het, dit was sy familie. Hier waar hy in die tronk is, juist ter wille van die koninkryk, juist ter wille van die Messias wat sou kom, koning Herodes, hy is nie die koning nie. En daarom het hy met groot oortuiging, krag, die man uit die woestyn, het die koninkryk aangekondig, het hy Herodes aangevat. Sekerlik, Jesus gaan die orde omver gooi. Net soos Elia die Baal profete doodgemaak het, toe hy vuur uit die hemel afgebid het van God, en dit alles gebrand het, en hulle die Baal profete doodgemaak het. Gaan Jesus nie ook die goddeloses en die skynheiliges, en ja, Herodes, aanvat, soos Elia, op aangevat het nie. En dan sal hy in die tronk uitkom en hy gaan deelneem in hierdie koninkryk wat kom, wat Jesus bring, die Messias. Maar dan gebeur iets anders, en hy hoor hierdie tyding daar waar hy in die tronk sit. Dink jy aan Johannes se skoene? Dink net, hier verwag jy dit, hier sit jy magteloos in die tronk, en dan jy verwag om daar die groot boodskap te hoor van Jesus is besig om die wêreld om te keer. Maar wat hy hoor is heel iets anders. Jesus maak vriende met tollenaars, met mense wat nie die wet onderhou nie. Jesus het baie wat hom volg. Hy doen groot dinge, maar nie die dinge wat hy verwag het nie. Ja, Jesus is besig om 'n groot reputasie op te bou, maar nie die reputasie wat hy verwag het nie. Ja, liewe luisteraar, as jy ook so voel vandag, dat jou lewe anders verloop as wat jy dink dit moes wees, of anders verloop het reeds, die Here dinge anders laat gebeur, hoe moet ek dan nou dink? Kan ek die Here op sy beloftes, wat hy vir my gegee het en gebede, dat dinge sal goed uitwerk, kan ek hom op sy beloftes neem? Kyk dan, as dinge anders gebeur, anders is in my lewe. Hoor die Here my nie? Is ek regtig goed genoeg in sy oë? Gee hy werklik om oor my? Hoekom gebeur hierdie slegte dinge met my? Verwerping, mislukking, siekte, so baie dinge wat ek nie verwag het nie. Is ek regtig sy kind? Is ek regtig deel van sy koninkryk? Gee hy regtig om vir my? Wil hy en sal hy werklik dinge verander in my lewe? Hoekom loop alles so skeef anders? Hier is die vraag waarmee baie van ons worstel. Die Here gee ons antwoord hier in hierdie verse. In Matteus 11. Eintlik wil ek al die hele Matteus 11 saam met julle lees. Maar kom ons vat dit stadig. Kom vat die Here op sy woord. Ons luister hierna. Ons gaan eerst nou na muziek luister en bly ingeskakel dan, gesels ons verder hieroor. Welkom terug by die ABBA-program Krag van die Woord. Ons bedink hierdie woorde van Matteus 11 vers 1 tot 6. En daarom as jy luister en jy is op 'n plek waar jy voel, maar dinge werk nie reg uit nie. Dinge werk so anders uit as wat ek gedink het. Hoekom loop dinge so anders? En dan begin ek twyfel, net soos Johannes in die tronk. Is dit werklik die Messias? Of ek vraag myself, geloof ek werklik in Jesus, die Messias, die koning? Jesus self het geen twyfel gehad, dat hy die Messias is nie. Die koning die Messias, want dit is wat dit beteken, die koning is besig om te doen wat God beloof het. Om werklik te herstel, in restaurasie te bring, herstel te bring. So Jesus sê vir Johannes, dis wat ek gekom het om te doen. Siekes gezond te maak, dowes te laat hoor, blindes te laat sien, verlammes, te laat loop, belaats is, gezond te word, dooies op te wek, en aan die armes die goeie boodskap te bring. Klink so anders as wat Johannes verwag het. Dit klink so anders as wat almal hom verwag het. Gedink het hoe die koninkryk werk. Sien, Johannes het ook nog nie die hele openbaring verstaan en gehad nie. Hy het gepreek, die koninkryk kom. Die oordeel van God kom, bekeer julle. Hy het ook nie verstaan dat, ja, dit is waar wat hy preek. Maar hoe dit gaan gebeur is anders as wat hy dink. Jesus gaan self die oordeel op hom neem. Jesus gaan self aan die kruis sterwe vir die sonde. En dan deur sy gees bring hy die vrymaking. Bring hy die terugkeer na God se weë deur die gees in ons om sy pad te loop, om die pad te loop om Jesus te volg. En daarom sê Jesus, laat weet hy vir Johannes, gaan vertel vir Johannes, wat julle sien, wat julle hoor, dis wat ek doen. Ek het nie gekom om oordeel aan ander te bring nie, ek neem die oordeel op my. Ek het nie gekom om die vrymaking te bring, deur vuur in die hemel te laat kom nie, ek neem die vuur op my, die oordeel van God op my, ek neem die sonde op my, en aan die kruis gaan ek dit laat inkom in my, en ek gaan dit alles doen, sodat alles betaal is. En nou is ek hier om heel te maak. Ja, dit is anders as wat jy verwag het, Johannes. En ja, liewe luisteraar, dit is anders as wat jy verwag hoe jou lewe moet werk. Want die Here is besig om jou vry te maak deur sy gees. Ja, daar sal die oordeel kom wat Jerusalem gaan vernietig. Maar dit is aards. En daar kom die oordeel, maar dit is om die wat in die koninkryk is, die nuwe aarde en die nuwe hemel te laat beerwe. En net soos wat ons gehoor het by Babel Projects, dit gaan juist die vrymaking, die pad uit die slavernij. En omdat ons nog steeds dan nou in die woestijn reis op hierdie oomblik, gebeur al hierdie goed wat ons verwar en wat hulle dink, nee, ek is nie 'n kind van die Here nie. Kyk net wat gebeur in my eie lewe. Kyk wat gebeur in my samelewing. Maar dit is waaroor dit gaan. Want hy het reeds dit vir ons bewerk, dat ons in hom die vrymaking van die bose ervaar, dat ons oorwinnend kan lewe deur die gees. Dis waaroor die koninkryk gaan, om heel te maak, die wat siek is gesond, om die boodskap, goeie boodskap in die armes te bring, ook die armes van gees, wat hy in die begin van die bergrede gesê het. Mens verstaan so Johannes' verwarring. Kyk, jy dink mense, omdat jy nie verstaan wat daar gebeur het nie, wat, jy verstaan eintlik nie Johannes, maar as jy mooi dink oor jou eie lewe, die verwarring wat daar so maklik kom, omdat jy dinge op 'n sekere manier verwag, maar dan doen die Here dit heel anders. Ons het dit by die radio ook ondervind. Ons het geweet, ons wil die Here volg. En die Here het ons deur 'n swaar en moeilike tyd gebring en het vrymaking gebring in elkeen wat deelneem ook op die radio. Maar juist op sy manier, nie wat baie van ons gedink het hoe dit werk nie. Baie twyfel gebring ook, het ek geen twyfel nie, ook in my. Maar die Here werk anders. Hy, die Here, maak heel, maak gesond, bring die lewe, die vryheid. Dit is wat die Here in my situasie doen. Dit is waar oor die koninkryk gaan. Dinge gebeur heel anders. Ek beleef verwerping, het mislukkings. Ek of iemand na my word siek. Ek beleef finansiële druk en swaar. My planne loop heeltemal skeef. Ek het tog so baie hieroor gebid en die Here gevra. Weet dan, liewe luisteraar, dat die Here, die Messias, die koning, bring vir jou genade, herstel en vrymaking. Dit is die hart van die koninkryk. Dit is wat hy doen in mense se lewens. Hy maak heel op 'n ander manier, op 'n heel ander manier, as wat jy en ek verwag. Sy lewe, wie sou dit kon dink, dat hy die Seun van God, die Koning, die Here, dat hy self as mens die pad geloop het van misverstand, selfs die mense wat na aan hom was, van verwerping, van swaar, van gebrek, en selfs dat sy naby mense, sy volgelinge, sy disippels hom sou verraai en verloon. Hy self sou sterf om weer op te staan uit die dood. Sal ons hom dan nie vertrou nie? Al werk alles so anders uit in jou lewe, anders as wat jy gedink het, sal ons dan nie juis in hom, ons koning, die is sy gees wat in ons woon, in vryheid lewe. Vry om te kan lief hê, vry om te kan goed doen, vry om God te kan vertrou, geduld, terwyl jy wag op die Here, om die heel werk, die heel maak werk in jou te bring. Hy is so anders, maar vertrou hom. Hy bring die koninkryk in jou en my. Kom ons luister na musiek en dan gesels ons verder. Bly ingeskakel. Welkom terug. Terwyl ons hier nadink, gesels oor die woorde van Jesus in Matteus 11 vers 1 tot 6. Johannes wat vra, is u die een wat sou kom? Deur sy volgelinge. En Jezus wat sê, blindes sien weer, verlamdes loop, melaates word gereinig, dowes hoor, dooies word opgewek, aan armes word die goeie boodskap verkondig. Kan jy sien, rondom jou, in jou, hoe die Here jou heel maak? Miskien nie, nie nou nie, maar jy kan ook vertrou, dis wat hy nou doen. En dan sê Jezus hierdie opmerklike woorde vir Johannes. En gelukkig is die mens, gelukkig of geseend, kan jy dit ook vertaal, geseend is die mens wat nie aan my aanstoot neem nie. So. Jezus, wat hy sê, hy seën jou. Hoewel dinge anders uitwerk as wat jy gedink het. Wanneer jy na hom draai en jy hom erken as die koning, en hom aanbid en hom vertrou, Hy seën jou. Hy gee dit vir jou hierdie lewe, hierdie vrymaking. Hierdie makarios, geseën, sê Jesus. Hy het dit in die begin van die saligspreking, dieselfde woord gebruik in Matteus 5. Salig, gelukkig, geseend is julle, die armes van gees, want aan hulle behoort die koninkryk van die hemele. Gelukkig is die wat treur, want hulle sal vertroos word. Gelukkig is die wat honger en dors na geregtigheid, want hulle sal versadig word. Geseend is jy, dus, as jy my woorde neem, en ek in jou werk, waar lê groot seëning in hom, om hom die Messias, die koning se woorde, sy verlossing, ernstig op te neem. Al is daar twyfel in jou, of verstaan jy nie mooi wat gebeur rondom jou nie. Om toch te weet, hy is die koning. En daaraan vast te hou. Een persoon gee ergens getuienis dat hy en sy vrou het julle paar kinders, maar twee van die kinders het ernstige lichamelike gebrek daarmee gebore. So dat hulle deur die ander kinders en ander versorg moes word. Die ma kry ook twee keer borskanker. En dan kan mens dink die finansiële druk wat met dit alles gekom het. En dan sê hy uiteindelik in getuienis, hy sê hy het die reg om te verstaan aan God teruggegee. Here, ek verstaan nie, maar ek gee het vir u. U is die Here. Al dink ek dinge moet anders wees by my. Dan leg ek my neer by die Here. Ek bring my seer, my twyfel, my vraag, bring ek na die Here. So het Job ook, na 'n worsteling by die Here, om aan die Here oorgegee. Nou weet ek, dat ek het die woorde gehoor, ek het die gesien. Hy is die Here. Kom by daai punt, hoe moeilik dit ook al is. Moenie dink, oeg, ek is nie goed genoeg nie. Ek is nie werd. Nee, die Here sê, hy het gekom om siekes gezond te maak. Hy het gekom om jou heel te maak. Vertrou hom. Moenie aanstoot neem in sy woorde nie. Glo hom. Weet dat hy die koning is. Ja, hy bring 'n onderste bo koninkryk. Dit lyk heel anders as wat ons dink hoe die lewe moet werk. Maar dit wat hy bring, is verlossing, is die pad uit die stikkenheid. En al beleef jy die pad in die woestyn, vertrou hom. Hy bring jou deur dit na die beloofde land, na die lewe by hom. Heel anders as wat ons dink. Maar die plek waar ons waarlik en heel mens kan wees, volledig, werp jy op hom. Hy is getrou. Here, wil u jy wat soveel deernis met die mens het, van die begin af die pad geloop het met die mensdom, om hulle waarlik te bring by die punt waar hulle totaal vrygemaak is, om te kan lewe uit u, die wyse waarop u gedoen het, Here, wie het dit verwag, dat u self sou kom, wie het verwag dat u op hierdie aarde sou lewe as mens? Wie het verwag dat U sou sterf aan die kruis, dat U sou opstaan. Heel anders as wat mense dit verwag het. En nou ook hier in my lewe, hier waar ek nie verstaan nie, hier waar dinge nie uitwerk nie, Here, ek weet. Ek weet dat U my hierdeur sal neem. Ek weet dat U sal my en almal om my, die armes van gees, die wat dors en honger het, dat U dit sal bring, heel maak, op U tyd. Ek vertrou U met my hele lewe, Here. Ek behoort aan U. En dit wat ek deel met almal om my, nie in bravade nie, maar een diepe liefde, diepe neerbuig voor U, diepe afhanklikheid, want U is die Here. Dankie Here. Amen. Het is heerlijk om saam met jou hierdie pad te loop. Ons gaan van volgende week net so een pose neem en meer begin kyk weer na die geboorte van Jesus, die oploop daarna toe, soos wat Matteus dit dan vir ons gee. En dan hierdie verhale oor die Exodus, en die pad wat ons ook in hierdie program nou genoem het. Volgende Sondag dan, begin ons weer. Groot genade en liefde. Tot ziens.
Hierdie inset was aan jou gebring met die komplimente van Radio Kaapse Kansel 729 AM. Besoek ons gerus by www.capepulpit.co.za.